The number of interrogations because of people leaving the seminar dropped to the point where I could write comments on it. So, which is what I prefer to do, is to each week read them and write comments as well. I can't give 100% guarantee that I'll do that every week, but I'll try to, because it's a better way for me to absorb the themes than to just read them through. I've grouped the comments in the way that's on the agenda. We have about an hour, so last time we had 2 hours and we got only through the first item.
Could be again.
I think the first four, they're all kind of bound up with the same sort of theme, this distinction between community enterprise and social enterprise, between these social economy organizations being partners with the state or partners with corporations versus grassroots activists in opposition. So those two faces or models of the social economy, that was a theme that came up in a bunch of the readings, of course, but also I think in different ways these four agenda items that Michael, Tyler, Nate, and Unhi. Is that how you pronounce Unhi? Unhi?
Yeah.
So we don't have to treat these one by one. I think these are kind of connected. So any one of those are the four people whose queries intersected this cluster of issues. So why don't the four of you begin the commenting and discussing of those in whatever order you want to.
Okay, I'll just, whatever, I'll bite the bullet. This issue, as it's framed here in the agenda, is sort of connected to other issues I brought up in my comments and that were brought up by other people in the comments as well. Something I'm not terribly interested or not trying to do, or actually trying to stay away from, is just defining the social economy as, like, stuff I like and, like, you know, not social economy as things I don't like as much or whatever. But to the extent that social economy has some non-capitalist or anti-capitalist characteristics, is maybe a a better way of thinking about it, and worth distilling. And so the issues that I was looking at here in terms of, like, comparing to capitalist firms or capitalist employment relations were, part of it was the issue kind of addressed in the, sort of what I tried to address in the email I sent out about the relationship with the labor market, which has to do something with what Tylan mentions, about sort of just employing unpaid labor to perform basically, you know, and I wish I could think of another lexicon, but basically reproductive functions of, i.e. reproductive of capital. And, you know, the payment and honoraria and so on. And then there's also the issue of the, I don't know, something that stuck out for me was training, training programs, job training programs for people who otherwise, wouldn't be in the job market. And so you're sort of, the relationship to the labor market is you're sort of expanding the pool of labor and creating a better market from capital's perspective. And not really guaranteeing these people employment. Though, you know, it is good to equip them with skills and so on. But the question also arises, well, in terms of coping mechanisms versus meeting new needs or creating whatever. You know, is the reason that these people being people with intellectual disabilities, mental illnesses, who otherwise would be under, you know, and, you know, arguably ought to be under care and not have to deal with the labor market, should they be kind of thrown into the labor market? And this is something that was in the MOOC and quarter reading that we did last week. And then finally, the last kind of thing I was looking at was the definition of cooperatives, and this is way down at the bottom actually, but has to do with this first point. The learning by doing and experimentalist way of defining or talking about the social economy doesn't strike me as different from capitalist firms, especially when you're looking at smaller and micro firms, capitalist firms. And the question kind of becomes, well, learning what by doing what? You know, there has to be some content. There has to be some substance to the statement, which I wasn't able to glean very well from the text. And so the question is partly about analytically situating the social economy in terms of defining it in a a definitive way from the capitalist sector or the private sector, and then also trying to see, like I said earlier, and like this theme I'm probably going to talk about all term is that, you know, the corrosive versus reproductive effects, and to what extent the social economy serves an anti-capitalist or a post-capitalist strategy, and to the extent it doesn't.
Yeah, I agree with Michael in the sense that in the way that some of the pieces depicted the emergence of the social economy was sort of saying, okay, the social economy has always been there. And at some point we had a crisis in the way that the private sector used to work, and then it opened an opportunity for what already existed to grow. And I'm not sure if the relation should be thought just like that, or whether we should understand the emergence or the relation between the social economy and the capitalism in a way that would be more looking at the dynamics of how in the capitalistic system you generate those kind of alternatives within the whole system. There are alternatives even to the private organizations, if I'm making a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think so.
This is hijacking a little bit towards the theme of the state, but I think it really much plays into the issue of how much does the state support the emergence of the social economy and how much does it suppress it? And how much this sort of either nurturing or like constraining of the social economy is, like, through the state, is part of like this capitalist dynamic you're talking about.
Just thinking about what Michael said initially about thinking about the labor market, I read that the part about the factory takeovers in Argentina, it's not fair that, you know, the employers, they didn't fulfill their moral obligations because they just abandoned these factories and they abandoned us as workers. But, like, when you look at it, what if every factory that was abandoned was reclaimed? Would they be able to, you know, sustain themselves? Like, the thing is that capitalism can't provide everybody a job. I mean, that's just how it works. And these job training programs don't really address that. And I mean, maybe with the organizations that create jobs, I'm kind of just thinking about it, like, they could either be, you know, producing for the market, or they could be on the margins of the market. They could just be, you know, subsistence on the margins. And I'm not really sure if that's a useful line of dividing that.
When you pose the issue as are the social economy initiatives corrosive or reproductive of capitalism, what would be an indicator of it being corrosive?
It can't be bringing capitalism to its knees.
Sure.
So what would? How would you know?
So I feel like there are a number of sort of things that, you know, from a strategic perspective that people, you know, in a movement for a post-capitalist society would like to see and would consider as contributing or constituting alternatives. And one of those things, I think, and so part of it, part of the term is that I just like the term. I just find it an attractive way of consolidating a whole number of things. And one of them, for example, can simply be ideological, in that you know, the cooperative structure, even if there's nothing structural or inherent about it that's anti-capitalist, may sort of engender an anti- or a post-capitalist ideology within people in and around the organization. And I think I would count that. And then you can also talk about institutions which try to, in some way or another, decommodify labor, such that you know, people are less dependent on capitalist markets for sustaining themselves and so on, and the you know, the disciplinary effect of capital is lessened and so on. So I think, you know, these are the main two things I've been thinking of.
On the first one, if you have a worker cooperative that's stable, that's egalitarian and democratic, so it embodies all these non-capitalist principles, which also embody what, if you were ideological about it, you would see as principles for transcending capitalism. But the actors in it just feel like they're living they're being productive, they're engaged in a community, they like it, but they don't have the categories of anti-capitalism. They just see themselves as having carved out a space where they can do their work well. That would be sufficient for you to say it's not anti-capitalist?
Oh, well, provided that it... So it doesn't necessarily have to be... For example, the second thing I said about like the tie into labor markets doesn't need to be ideological, I think. It's not a prerequisite.
But this isn't... it's not exactly decommodified. They're producing for... They still earn their living through the sale of things in a market. They're not selling their labor power because they're in work. They're in a co-op.
So you're asking specifically about a co-op?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'm saying in a way that I don't mean to sound like it's a setup. I'm hesitant to require consciousness of the actors as a criterion for whether or not this counts as something which is a genuine alternative, as opposed to something which is simply reinforcing and strengthening capitalism. You know, it seems to me that's too demanding a criterion, the ideological.
And there's also, I mean, I also don't mean to be totally dichotomizing the thing. There can be sort of in the middle where it's not, you know, we talked about non-capitalist, but it's neither anti-capitalist nor pro-capitalist, and I think that I don't want to give the impression that I'm eliminating the sort of more neutral category, but I do see what you mean, and I do understand the basis for skepticism regarding consciousness of actors as a criterion, and I do think it's worth thinking about.
Aicha, did you have anything?
Yeah, it's just I agree that an organization which has members with the anti-capitalist consciousness might in fact at the end strengthen capitalism, or it might be the case that, you know, people who just, you know, choose without any kind of consciousness, this might be corrosive too. So I see that that's quite an ambivalent and difficult question to answer, but then it seems to me that consciousness might play an important role if we think that the context might change, and in that case people can find new strategies or new ways of well, innovating, basically, different, you know, organizations or different ways of, that might be important. Whereas, you know, that might be the problem. So it's like when the opportunity arises, okay, this is, I know it's kind of totally sounds speculative, but what will happen when the circumstances or the context changes? And this can be just not, you know, 100 or 200 years, but let's think of 50 years. And in that case, that might be important in that aspect.
And I think another aspect, apart from the ideological aspect, is the capacity to act like context independent, if that makes any sense. So what I mean by that is like the resilience of the movement in itself, so like independent, for example, of like any kind of favorable laws from the state to kind of support the formation, like the continuation of the cooperative, like that's one example of the cooperative. So I'm not sure what kind of form that would take, but I think that's like a really quite important element additional to the kind of consciousness about the kind of process they're involved in.
Well, that's why in my interrogation by producing this question, I was thinking about the example in Quebec. I mean, this social movement characteristic of the Quebecois experience is, I think, really important. I mean, rather than standing alone and working cooperative, relying on the market sales of the products and or only keeping the egalitarian and non-capitalist functioning of the labor relations within the firm or cooperative itself or within a certain area. I mean, that example, that this Quebec example stands, I mean, offers really good insight in terms of how to create a step towards something, whatever that something is. Because, it seems to me, I think that Quebec works through social economy only. I don't know whether capitalism exists in Quebec because of our readings. This and that. I mean, there's this imagining some sort of alternative haven for the people. But still, I think this social movement characteristic is important. For instance, that also holds true for the Basque Country regarding the, I don't know, regarding the historical context of the Basque Country itself, why being, having this guerrilla movement and opposition party in the parliament, which has been closed, etc. But still, along with the ideological transformations or rising consciousness, I think the important part is the really have impact on different parts of the life in terms of transforming these existing social relations. I mean, as in a big community, being able to transform maybe not all the sorts of capitalist the relations which are produced by the capitalist economy, but taking a step towards there comes from more wide and I don't know. I think that network of networks idea, I found that really interesting in terms of giving an insight to for the transformative characteristics of social economy.
So one way of framing that would be to say that the formation of networks and the anchoring of these initiatives in social movements enhance the anti-capitalist potential of these innovations. That it increases the potential anti-capitalist effects. It enables a more secure and stable space for these alternatives. It does all that. But the characterization of the social economy as anti-capitalist still depends upon the character of what it actually does, not on these other considerations. That will determine how important it is, how threatening it might be, what its potential is under new historical conditions, and all of that. So just as a weak labor movement and a strong labor movement can both be regarded as organizations of workers struggling against capitalism, they don't have to be effective to count as that. just that if they're weak, they're not going to be effective. They don't have the backing of a set of networks and social bases, they're going to be more marginal. But so, I mean, my tendency is to try to identify the anti-capitalist character of these in the character of what they do and how they do it. That is, are they organized in a way that embodies egalitarian and democratic principles, and are they producing things directly to satisfy needs rather than to, acquire profits through a market? And then different organizations have more or less of an anti-capitalist character. It's not a dichotomy. Nate, you were one of the people who mm-hmm. wrote on this theme, characterizing it a slightly different way, but I think it's the same.
Yeah, I was thinking something else with regard to what you just said, but I was thinking that in the readings there's a feeling of thinking about the social economy in the way that you would think about it in a business school, which I think we're accustomed to thinking of as a sort of capitalist mode, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. I mean, it's just sort of a way of talking about enterprises and organizing enterprises and how people work together that feels not social movement-y, not activist-y. And that there were certain readings, like the reading from Poland, which felt, almost like a pure type of that. And there were other readings that felt like the other side, if there are only two sides of this, which was the sort of social movement activist feeling of the social economy. And that what I was thinking several comments ago was that this may just be a sort of a form of code switching, that, when you're going into a partnership with some other actor because, you need some sort of support in order to have your enterprise happen, you speak the business code if you're, seeking support from, I guess a corporation would be an extreme example, or you speak, if you have a state that respects, activism and, social movements, you speak that. Or you can speak the business mode to the state if that's what they want to hear. So I guess that's sort of how I was thinking of that, the two ways of talking about it fitting into this discussion.
That's a real interesting complement to that is, I was posing it as these not two models in the sense of discourses, mm-hmm. but two models in the sense of accounts of actually how these organizations work and function as businesses fitting into the capitalist economy or as expressions of movements challenging the way capitalism works.
Yeah, and I wasn't thinking about it.
But there is a connection between these.
Right.
And connecting back to what we said a little bit about funding, it could be that although it is code switching, you strategically deploy the business school model when you're trying to extract some funds from a corporate sponsor. It could be also that the code switching does redound back on how you actually engage in your practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's possible that a particular organization, particular people in a particular organization switch codes when they're talking to different people in the organization or when they want to change the way the organization operates. Mm-hmm. They say, well, we need to make this more efficient in like a business, or we need to make this more participatory, like, a community organization.
There are questions here, Anne, and then.
I guess I just have a couple of comments. One is sort of the function of ownership that came across to me in various in these as sometimes fuzzy. It wasn't always clear who actually owned the organization, and does that matter? Because I think a lot about ownership in a nonprofit sector, because I'm on the boards of nonprofits, and there is virtually no ownership, and what effect does that have on the organization? But I sort of have to talk about capitalism a little bit, and maybe because I hang out with all these capitalist economists in my work life, they don't understand cooperatives, and this doesn't matter what kind of co-op. Land O'Lakes, as a huge example, is not a capitalist firm. I mean, the owners are the farmers, all of the capital, all of the equity for that corporation, cooperative corporation, is supplied by the farmers, one way or another. They don't have access to capital, and that's what these economists see, is the differentiation between any cooperative, from the biggest to the smallest, from a capitalist firm. And the role of capital in an investor-owned firm is amoral. I mean, there is one function that a capitalist firm provides, and that is to increase the value of the investment that investors have made in that firm in the form of money, and it's transferable and it's amoral. And a cooperative, no matter what size, is significantly different, because the purpose of the cooperative is to serve the needs of a group of users of that cooperative. And I guess I'm not going to argue that. I guess I would say that it probably is in the non-capitalist realm rather than anti-capitalist. I'm certainly not going to argue that Land O'Lakes is anti-capitalist, but it's not a capitalist firm. And I do think that if we look at, say, the Quebec experience, which is incredibly impressive, the organizations are niche actors in many ways. And if we're going to look at post-capitalism and the needs of the billions of people on this planet, we have to be looking at a different way of organizing capital and investment, and cooperatives of any type provide that. So sorry, that was a small speech.
Steve had a double-hander. So.
Yeah, I want to, I think this, starting from the point of capital needing to be invested and reproduce itself in larger quantities, right, to be increased, to me that seems like a good place to assess anti-capitalism. And now Land O'Lakes, I don't know the history of it, but you know, I know a little bit about farming history, and you know, the problem for farmers was that they could be exploited.
It started out, right, in the 1880s in Minnesota, absolutely, totally exploited individual actors.
Right, so capitalists could have come in,
yep,
right, and occupied that role and used it to reproduce capital, right, or to increase their capital. So Land O'Lakes stopped that,
right? Absolutely.
So in that way, it was anti-capitalist.
Absolutely.
I would
argue. But in its beginning phases, absolutely.
Yeah, so, or it prevents, and today still it prevents it. So I'm wondering if there are like very simple metrics that we might use, like, so if you're, say, removing people from the need to sell their labor power, if you have cooperatives in an area, then in a particular industry in significant numbers, then we should see the price of labor rise for companies, right? In the same way, we should see a decline in profitability, right? So if we compared 1,000 cities that had food co-ops and didn't, right, those, the food sellers where there are no co-ops should have higher profitability. I mean, that would be, I mean, I think a simple way to think about anti-capitalism. I mean, it might also prevent the commodification of social services, right? So rather than having elderly care or child care, for instance, in Quebec, right, this was the claim by the capitalists, right, that you were preventing them from commodifying this service, right, or at least turning it into a true capitalist endeavor. So maybe, you know, the other role in terms of not the traditional market economy stuff that we think about in terms of worker co-ops, but in terms of social services, maybe what it's doing is preventing. Again, you could compare places where the co-ops are not.
Matt and then Trevor.
Seems like different folks in the room are working with different definitions of what capitalist means, or possibly at least. I mean, if capitalism is, so for example, if capitalism is a financial investment that produces goods and services that are sold and the surplus is privately appropriated, if that's all capitalism is, then Land O'Lakes is as capitalist as they come. It's
investor ownership is the difference. It's the ownership. Who owns it?
Yeah. Well, or is it who owns it, or is it who appropriates it, or is it who?
I looked at capitalism in Wikipedia because, you know, honestly, I was curious. And investor ownership is a key difference. Investor of money.
According to the Wikipedia author's definition of capitalism, the point is that there are different definitions of capitalism.
Yeah.
I'll let you continue, but there's a term hander.
So I don't know the answer to this question. And how is Land O'Lakes different than the venture to drill oil from the deep water in the Gulf, which is owned by a number of different private firms that have invested and have ownership stakes in that?
Who owns those firms?
Well, who owns the farms?
Their family farms.
Okay.
So, but in both cases,
but they may have, you know, an employment. I mean, a family farm is also a business, which is a type of business that may have employees that are. I don't know. I mean.
So it's a pretty bit different financial model.
No, obviously it's a different.
Really different financial model.
Yeah.
I mean, one solution might be to return to a very old, you know, idea of where profit comes from, right? Which would be that the value that's created, or the capitalist value that's created by something other than the alternative to Land O'Lakes, is based on exploitation from that labor power in that labor process, which is not now being produced. There's no surplus value, okay, you know, produced when you're by Land O'Lakes. So that is just taken out of the end price of the commodity, for the good.
But
very briefly, I'm just throwing in, like, does it really matter, like, how you function? This is not that we should, like, identify, like, the negative aspects of whatever, like, the capitalist system is, and then kind of contrast, like, social economy against those kind of negative aspects, no matter what the kind of dominant underlying process is. I mean,
Well, definitions matter because they either obscure or clarify the mechanisms involved. So some people define capitalism just as markets. And that, I think, obscures some fundamental differences. So that I would argue there are different kinds of market organizations, some of which are non-capitalist but still markets, and that makes a very big difference. And calling them all capitalist then obscures what the crucial mechanisms are. So Steve was proposing one kind of mechanism. Is labor exploited in a capitalist manner? Labor is exploited in a capitalist manner if there's wage labor that performs labor in a labor process, in which the products of that labor are appropriated by the employer. Okay, so Land O'Lakes is a dairy processing. They produce things, that is, they have inputs from the farmers, raw milk, and they produce butter and milk and, I don't know, do they do cheese too? And cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So they produce all the stuff. There are workers in that firm producing that stuff. Those workers are wage laborers. They get hired and fired.
That's the thing that I'm talking about. That just blows my mind away. I mean, because, okay,
So from all those points of view, Land O'Lakes makes a profit, sells stuff above the cost of production, and the surplus that it generates comes in significant ways from the laboring activity of its employees. So in those respects, it is a capitalist firm. But in one crucial respect, it deviates from capitalism. There's nobody can invest in it. No outsider can invest in it. You can't buy a share of it. The farmers who own it
get the returns.
Get the returns, and they are themselves direct producers. So it's a I would say it's a hybrid form.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hybrid form that has some capitalist aspects and some non-capitalist aspects.
But so can you not? You cannot invest in Cargill, which is like this huge privately owned firm.
Right, but they invest.
But you can't invest in it. But still, it's like a hyper-capitalist firm, right? I mean, private companies in general. I mean, maybe I just don't understand like the notion of investing into it. But like they're privately owned, you can't invest in it. And then you know, they're family owned in a huge international conglomerate. I can't imagine another example of it.
A way of giving some precision to this issue for an enterprise like Land O'Lakes, does it differ from a wholly owned family firm in which the members of that family own 100% of it, they invest their own money in it, the farmers invest their own resources into this firm, and they appropriate the profits as a result. So one way of saying about Land O'Lakes is that it really is very close to a capitalist firm in a lot of ways. The one thing that makes it at least seem different is that the constituent members who are the owners are themselves direct producers. And that, yeah.
And along with that, just quickly, they also have democratic governance. I mean, it may be obscure, but it is there is a democratic process. And I would also argue that, say, in Quebec, the existence of those farmer-owned cooperatives for all those years set the stage, potentially, for what they have in the social economy, because they had a tradition of democratic governance of their marketing organizations.
In my visual counting of whose hands were up, Nina and Trevor and Lindsay and Juhi have their hands up in some unspecified order, however. I think Trevor might have been first and then Nina.
Just two thoughts, they came a while ago, so. One was just that we've been talking a lot about the labor relations component, but what about the consumer cooperatives or public services that are provided, where the stakeholders that matter for the cooperatives are not just the workers, but also the members of the community? And so how do we think of that in terms of capitalist or anti-capitalist? Mm-hmm. And the second one that I was thinking of, in terms of measuring outcomes, as I'm reading a lot of these cases, I'm thinking about how does sort of the capitalist system provide these individuals or groups with access to these necessary resources, whether it's a public service or whether it's like a certain wage to provide basic goods, and does this new organization provide them with an alternative which does not rely on like market processes? In the case of these Australian organizations, where essentially their means of maintaining themselves is to essentially operate at a suboptimal sort of market position. They're not maximally profitable. They are receiving some volunteer labor. They are paying workers less, or maybe they're receiving some sort of subsidy from the government. But because of those resources, they don't have to rely on, they don't have to compete in markets in the same way as other firms.
Nina.
So there have been a lot of tracks, so I don't know if there's any comments for that.
Yeah, there is always the inevitable flow of comments in a seminar means that there is occasional disjunctures where lines are, that's where the one hand, two hand thing comes in. But I think we can still move on, just, because there's a lot of things that we want to talk about.
Yeah, I'm back to this about like selling your labor. You mentioned as well, this was Argentina example where the workers got together and to go in this company. When I read that, they were happy, but still it's a little bit sounds like they were working for a longer time. They sometimes have to stay late in the evening. Like, there was lots of things that was not, should say, good. And if it had been a capitalist place, we would have said, this is really bad, but someone wants you to do this. So I just want to ask of just the thing that you are an owner make you much happier, make you, it's so much easier to work late in the evening, and do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think the difference is the workers chose to do that, they weren't told to.
But did they choose that in that Argentina, they have to choose between not having a job or doing this? I think
especially in that case, it's like it was not really a choice they had. It's kind of what I was thinking. I think there you could either have, and I'm having a hard time thinking about the consumer, but like, okay, you could have, you have assets at the front end of things that you employ production, and like that could be inseparable from your work. Like you don't have access to these assets because you own them. It's because you work and you use them. That's on the front end, and on the back end, you have an inseparability between the products and the need or labor effort. And it's hard to think of like how do you create that inseparability when you have private property. It's like they have to kind of do it in an indirect way a lot of times. Like either, like I guess all the people who do labor in a factory could own them, but that brings up all sorts of problems where you have like the Mondragon and you have to work for a year because it's, because you're investing so much. Or else you could just have this third party organization where like nobody really owns it and then everybody just kind of controls it. And that would also maybe create some sort of inseparability. But then the other problem with this, and thinking about like capitalist versus non-capitalist versus anti-capitalist, is just because you access assets or products by virtue of your labor effort or your need does not mean that you associate. And I think that this kind of brings this thing that happens a lot with social movement organizations, is that they kind of lose their mobilizational character over time unless you're really vigilant and unless you keep engaging people. And
there is Juhi had these are two handers that are directly on this. Otherwise, Juhi was in the queue.
I just have a clarifying question.
Yeah. Okay.
What do you mean by you said something about doesn't mean they associate or something? What?
Like just because, and I'm thinking more. I think this is a stronger tendency amongst the need and products, but just because you have access to this product and you're in this group of people who has access to this product doesn't mean that you all like voluntarily associate with each other. You may not have, you may not know them, you may not be involved with them at all. It's just kind of more of a passive relation.
The point being then, what exactly?
Oh, yes, the point of that being, I think that in order to like pose change to capitalism, you need to build your organizational capacity, mm-hmm. and when you're just accessing things without associating, you're not doing that.
You can't escape capitalism even though.
Okay. Nina, you had your two hands popped up, right?
Yeah, I don't know, like it's, I can't help thinking about this because now we're talking about all the co-ops and all the good things about like being a part of like this social community, and especially this Argentina example, and I can't help thinking about those Marxist theories that talk about the big problem that you're actually beginning to take your spare time into your work and you're getting your kids taken care of and you can get dinner home, and you know, all these kind of things, and some theories think is really, really bad because you can't separate your work from your private life, and mm-hmm. then the work or the capital life take over all your life, not only like your work time. And in some way, it's actually what we're talking about when we talk about like co-ops as a good thing. Yeah.
Juhi, and then I'll comment on
In the discussion about how to define the non-capitalist form and capitalist form, I think, I mean, someone would issue that, I mean, the land is, even though, I mean, there might be some capitalist characteristic inside, but I think it's different with the other forms because they distribute the surplus depend not based on their investment. They distribute the surplus based on their using the form. So I think it's a very important point. And also, someone said like ideology in the form or the how to, I mean, the people inside the form can be very anti-capitalistic, or it's also important, but I think it's not main, I mean, it's an important part, but it might not be the most important part. For example, there could be a very small, like a very ideologically very motivated form, like labor cooperatives. and also there is a big like credit union, which in like looks like capitalistic form, but the people are not that ideologically like left, for example, but the impact of the society might be different. This capital is not going around to earn money. Like this capital does not go to they don't invest in other country, and then they just take the money and left. They don't do it, right? So I think it's important also like the size. I mean, even though this form, small form is also, I mean, it's very valuable, but doesn't make sense. So I don't think ideology is not that. It's important, but it's not like the biggest part.
Steve.
Just real quick. Just to follow up on that and the idea of social movements, maintaining their strength or globalization. I mean, I think a lot of the readings and some of the comments and the interrogations, make it seem like people think social movements and these service providers and other organizations need to exist or coexist the entire time that these services are provided. Where, the way I see social movements is they're a movement, right, to change society, and then they end, right? You establish the social relations that you want, or the whatever reality you want to bring about, and then the social movement, disappears. I mean, they're another prefigure of social movements that, presumably continue, but.
In the context of these social economy discussions, such as in Quebec, they're using the term social movement in a slightly more general way, I think, than that. That is, you can refer to the environmental movement as a social movement, because it'll never end. That is the movement, the need to mobilize people in an ongoing way, and then to have a capacity for that mobilization by having some stable organization, has an indefinite time horizon. So maybe notionally, once the environment is secured and saved and sustainable, you would no longer have environmental movements. You won't have social justice movements once you have social justice. Nevertheless, I don't think it's a kind of temporary interim kind of organizational logic. So the idea about the social economy in Quebec is that you need ongoing organizations that are embedded in communities that create these dense networks in order to prevent these actual economic initiatives of the social economy from either becoming marginalized or absorbed in the prevailing forms. That's needed for their reproducibility. Kathleen,
So if industrialism ended, we went back to the land, right, as Earth First wants us to do. Would we need Earth First anymore? Would we need the environment movement? So if socialism or socialist efforts succeeded in destroying capitalism, would we need socialist efforts anymore?
If you have a complete inertial theory of social reproduction, you wouldn't. But if you believe that the tendency for capitalist forms to reemerge, so let us suppose that the only feasible form of socialism still has a substantial role for markets, but that the markets are populated by worker co-ops and other forms of collective enterprise, including state enterprise, rather than by private capitalist firms. There could still be a belief that there would be a continual tendency for capitalism to reemerge, to break out of whatever niches it's in. And therefore, there would be a need for vigilance. Now, one could say, okay, the vigilance comes from the state because a set of laws were in place, but what's going to keep those laws intact from being eroded, from being marginalized, unless there's some kind of social movement? Now, eventually, history has cases where social movements around particular themes really do disappear because it's settled once and for all. It's epically settled. We don't have abolition movements on slavery anymore in the United States because the defeat of slavery and the elimination of that form of production was decisive and then was finished by the
civil rights movement in the sense of the Jim Crow sharecropping visions, versions of post-chattel slavery, pre-capitalist still forms of labor that have disappeared. So we don't have social movements around abolition in the U.S. But I don't think socialism would be like that because of the, at least not in any foreseeable future. I don't think the transcendence of capitalism, now we're speaking more in a utopian mode rather than a new utopian mode. I don't think the transcendence of capitalism will have the character of the transcendence of slavery. That is, a decisive, once and for all, epical elimination of a form that won't have a tendency to reemerge in new permutations and new forms. Kathleen, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I just have a couple thoughts. One is I like Steve's comments about the long-term, issue of whether or not social movements are done, because my notes included things like that about the perpetually alternative, which I think is important in making your definitions clear. Can anybody ever achieve something? Can anybody ever be an organization that is alternative enough, right? That satisfies, a number of different criteria. Because otherwise we have this moving target that's just alternative and it's not definitional, it's not defined. And I see it a lot in the food movement when I think about the difference between the Willow Street Co-op and Whole Foods. People espouse Whole Foods as this great, food company, and they do a lot of really good things. They do a lot of things that they do local food, which was one of the criteria that people wanted was, employ local farmers. And so they did that. And they have this number of different things. So, their big difference is, they capitalized their firm, on investors. They didn't originally do that, but eventually they did. So that their profits go to, their investors. And, the co-op's profits, because they do earn profits, right, go back to their users and according to, your use, right? So how much you're using it, that's the amount of money that you get back in profits, and the co-op retains the rest of that. And shares, you get a number of shares in a corporation and you are, given profits based on how many shares you have. So it's the same idea of proportionality. The difference is, to me, really underlying difference is whether or not you use the products for which you are associated, right? So I'm getting profits because I use it. And the other one is, I'm not using it. I don't care about whether I'm using it or not. Right? It's everybody else. So in my mind, that's how I make a distinction between the differences.
Maybe we should move on to the next cluster of questions, just so we can at least have some discussion of them. The next two questions, both in different ways, I think, concerned the question of the relationship of social economy organizations to class and class relations. This is not quite the same as whether they're partners or adversaries. It's a question of the nature of the form itself. Lindsay was interested in, I think, understanding the class character of the people inside of the social economy. They're mobilizing the surplus population or the class relations of people working in social economy organizations. And I wasn't quite sure what Michael was meaning when he was invoking unpaid labor, whether you just meant volunteers or whether you meant surplus labor.
I meant something along the lines of, how activists and lefties kind of refer to domestic labor, for example, as labor that's reproductive of capitalism, but isn't paid labor, isn't quite wage labor, but still has a
it's
other
not
capitalism.
By virtue of it being unpaid that it's reproductive of capitalism. It just turns out that those activities are reproductive of capitalism, irrespective of whether they're paid or unpaid.
Yeah, I don't think I.
I mean, the unpaidness doesn't have anything to do with its reproductiveness in the domestic labor case.
I don't think I meant to make the point that its unpaidness had anything to do with its reproductiveness in this case either.
Okay, that's what I I thought, because you kept emphasizing the unpaid labor, I thought that that was what was salient about it, is that it wasn't paid,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, I mean, all...
Well, the idea is that it's if it's both unpaid and beneficial for capitalism, then maybe we have a problem here in terms of like talking about it as social economic labor. But I'm not sure. It was sort of a question I meant to pose rather than a I don't know, like a decisive something or other. Do you see what I'm trying to say? A little bit.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't quite clear on what the question was, but also Lindsay, maybe you want to talk about the issue you wanted to.
Okay. Well, I was thinking about the role of social economy organizations in different contexts, like specifically in the global north and the global south. And there are these people like Hernando de Soto who kind of use like microfinance of collectives as a means to incorporate people who are not employed into the economy. And so you have all these little microfinance in the global south, but then you also have all these kind of, I was thinking a lot about the war on poverty, like in the 70s, how you also had like a lot of government and private initiatives to fund all these community development programs in the urban core too. And I was thinking, there's kind of this tension throughout the readings, but the social economy organizations can either unintentionally or intentionally de-radicalize people. And they can do that by, it's ideological and organizational. They could either kind of give out jobs and services on the basis of like humane and sympathetic grounds, and that's it. Or they can, you know, kind of highlight kind of the injustice of the situation, make people conscious of their rights. And I was thinking that in different contexts, whether or not there's like, you know, a strong labor movement, or whether it's not really a labor movement at all, or whether there are a lot of workers or not a lot of workers, that kind of dynamic between like where these social economy organizations are coming from is going to make it so that people gaining jobs and services are going to relate to them differently.
Mm-hmm. This also connects to this issue of employment insertion and the reduction of marginalization and exclusion. So a lot of what social economy organizations try to do, at least one big section of them, is to provide a strategy for social inclusion more effectively than when this is done by large state-run bureaucracies. So the claim is that having community-based organizations attempting to deal with whatever the central dimensions of exclusion might be, this will vary across places, that community-based organizations operating outside of a market logic or a state logic are more able to contend with these problems for various reasons. And they can do so in a way then that provides services and employment. So a lot of these social organizations, social economy organizations in Quebec, there are many cases where they are providing a service of some sort, but simultaneously training and employing people who otherwise would be on the margins. But they're being employed productively. They're doing something that is a social contribution, but again, in this non-market, non-state, community-based way. So the question is, does that count as something which is simply absorbing and de-radicalizing people who would otherwise, by virtue of their marginality, be more anti-system? Or is that really not the way to think about these things? That whether or not people are radicalized or not radicalized isn't a function of whether they're being included or excluded through these kinds of mechanisms. That's not how we should assess these things, yeah.
Could you maybe think about it just in the contrast, because you mentioned microcredit, and you know that often does go with these microenterprises, and I think they talked about that. So, you know, there is that that idea that what we support is these small individual entrepreneurs, versus supporting people within a social organization. So, you know, and in both cases you're providing work, but is that a different experience, the association of what you're talking about?
And it's a much better way of putting it, like how do the unemployed or people in corporate, how do they perceive themselves in that?
Buried in this is the question of whether it's moral or desirable for human emancipation purposes for people who are not conventionally employable in the capitalist economy to become employable in the capitalist economy, especially in developing countries in global south. It could be an alternative. The alternative isn't, at least a short-term alternative, isn't necessarily, oh, they go for social, they start a communist revolution, or they work for Nike. It's, they work for Nike or they starve to death in some cases. And so, on the one hand, the answer could very well be both, in so far as it does, there's a moral imperative that's being actualized by facilitating their employment in the conventional economy. Even though that would seem to be eroding short-term prospects for revolution, if not long-term.
Well, I don't think it's... I don't think that's you know, people who, by giving them employment, you absorb them into the system and make them less radical, because then, like Marx was talking about lumpen proletariat, which really wouldn't contribute to the revolution. So I think people probably gain, understand themselves and their environments with how they relate to their work. Of course, which then makes us turn to the question of, you know, what kind of work and what kind of work environment they're in. I mean, if you put this person who otherwise would be unemployed in some kind of assembly line type of, the capitalist corporation, I mean, yes, you probably would make the person mainstream and would basically, the situation would reproduce capitalism. But if the person is in a cooperative or in a different work environment, that might open up other possibilities, and that might change the person's worldview.
So becoming a working class person in Nike would definitely help people to long for socialism too. I mean, it's not too obvious thing. I mean, proletarianization, like you said, but microfinance is. I mean, I don't. I jumped in. I'm sorry, but microfinance is a really. I mean, it's most common in the poorest two countries around the world. I mean, not poorest two, but where the inequality is more deep, in Bangladesh and Bolivia. And this is a big cooptation strategy, actually. I mean, to giving and portraying as a salvation is another ideological thing. And actually, the interest rates they charge for microcredits from those people are huge. They're not even talked about. Just to,
you know, yeah, go ahead.
Just one thing, just so again, with my thing about the who's, you know, you're investing in something you're using versus you're investing to capitalize a business. I mean, microfinance, you're not using that stuff. I mean, you're giving money, you're investing money, just like a person does in a company, right? You invest, and it's a very small company.
Some of these concerns are really only concerns if you entertain the possibility of a ruptural transformation, in which you have as your theory of rupture that basically the more miserable people are, the more likely they are going to overthrow the system, as it were. I mean, that's the kind of scenario which says that providing training and employment which inserts people into capitalist firms is somehow retarding the revolution. You need both a ruptural theory of revolution, of transformation, and a particular view about the conditions of rupture. Now, I think the historical evidence with respect to rupture is that it is not the case that the worse the conditions are, the more likely to rupture. Mm-hmm. Because the key obstacle to rupture is collective action, not grievance. There's plenty of grievance. There's enough grievances around for, if ruptures are a reasonable strategy, there's enough grievances around for them in most countries. The problem is the capacity to mobilize around those grievances, and the capacity for mobilization depends more upon being integrated into capitalism rather than marginalized from it. So even on those terms, I think insertion policies, anti-exclusion policies, create more rather than less favorable conditions for mobilization. But furthermore, I think if you're skeptical about ruptural solutions, ruptural transcendence, and you think that interstitial and symbiotic transformations, that is those that have a much longer and messier scenario for how transformation occurs, then the key issue here, which maybe somebody raised, is if you're going to have a social economy initiative, which is inclusionary and prepared and inserts people back into the economy, the key question is, how is that organized? Is that organized in a participatory and an egalitarian way, or as a Catholic charity with a hierarchical structure to provide services? So you can have progressive or non-progressive forms of insertion. And are people being inserted in, is there the possibility of expanding the opportunities for people to be inserted into cooperative enterprise as opposed to conventional capitalist firms? And both of those then would create more interstitial possibility and pose more of an ongoing alternative than would be the case either if you have a state bureaucratic provision of insertion. Sometimes states can do a pretty good job in providing literacy courses and job training thing to get people who are marginalized into work. That can happen. The state can provide that. It's not always the case that you need a social economy enterprise for doing it. But the state's providing it then in a way that is not itself prefigurative of an alternative. So I think those are the ways to think about those issues rather than just whether or not the result of the process is expanding the scope of capitalist employment or training people in ways that makes them more available to be exploited capitalistically. Yeah.
But one problem I'm having is that I'm trying to understand what is the process and what is the outcome. If the question is about how this this organization is structured, is that the outcome that we're looking for? In terms of, we know that we're seeing transformation if the social economy is, the social economy organizations are structured in this way, then we are seeing transformation. Or is it, in order to see transformation, the social economy organizations need to be structured this way? Or is it both?
No, the structure is a criterion of transformation, not just a cause of transformation. So, I think the part of the thesis which is clearest is that if you organize the production of goods and services in a democratic and egalitarian and inclusionary way, that is constitutive of it, counts as a transformation of capitalist relations, which then may be expansive or niche. That's a separate question. So the first question is, is this an instance of the production of a new form of social relations? And the second question is, does that ramify to produce more transformation? Is that a kind of node? The second strategic question, is that the best way to produce more transformation? That's less certain. It could be, the Bolshevik view was, what you want is a disciplined organizational weapon that is governed by democratic centralist principles where people can, follow the party line, that's the way to transform the world, even though that's not the kind of world you want. You can't make an omelet without breaking an egg. And all the different metaphors for how the means don't have to prefigure the end. And that was all. That also went along with the kind of ruptural vision that is, you know, the smash first, build second, as a caricature. Interstitial transformations generally are based on an organizational theory of change in which the process has to prefigure the destination in order to produce that movement towards that destination. But that should be viewed as a hypothesis. I don't think that's a truism. You know, it's not a truism. And there may be historical moments when it's a falsism. It seems to me a reasonable hypothesis. I think it's a very powerful conjecture that if you want a democratic egalitarian world, you have to create it through democratic egalitarian organization, prefiguring the world you want to create. You know, the Gandhi and be the world you want to be, the change you
wish
want
to see in the world.
That makes deep intuitive sense, both because of the demonstration aspect, that is, it because of the powerful negative message of hypocrisy, you know, that is, if you are living this life, that is a moral statement to others, and therefore, but if you're not, if you're an authoritarian speaking out in favor of free speech, people are more likely to be skeptical, even though it may be the case that there are historical moments where having an iron fist is the best way to promote free speech. I don't think this should not be regarded as a matter of logic. You know, it's sociologic, not logic. It may be that you have to violate your principles in order to achieve your principles. That could be the case. Yeah.
Maybe part of the transformation is it's the as these, you know, whatever social economy structures that are understood to be social economy structures expand, it's sort of a normalization project, but that's understood by the people who are taking part in those as normal rather than different. Mm-hmm. It's not the social economy, it's the economy. And at some point between the consciousness changes not to, this is strange to be a part of a co-op, it's, oh boy, that's strange to be working in that firm where you don't have ownership, the ownership stake in the firm. And so that's the consciousness side of it, and a sort of denaturalization of capitalist behavior side. And then that sort of the social economy becoming normal creates social power that makes little bits of capitalist activity illegal or contrary to what society will allow. And we understand that to involve, you know, state power. That's the line from social power to state power to, you know, social democratic regulation of private power. But, you know, if this becomes a sort of a normal understanding of how people behave in enterprises, then you say, oh, why don't we make this type of contract contrary to public policy? And we'll change that. And then that changes the understanding. And so that, I would understand that as corrosive, eventually, of little bits and pieces of how capitalist firms operate. Maybe there's some tipping point there, but does it feel like a revolution, or does it feel sort of...
I mean, I think an example of that is, in what context do people just expect that their voice will be heard? That they have, it's just the natural thing that they're not going to be bossed around by arbitrary unilateral decisions of others. Right? So it used to be in American universities that deans had absolute power over departments, and the chairs of department unilaterally decided who to hire. That was a traditional way that, and in some European contexts, it's still run that way. In American universities, the standard taken for granted assumption is that a department, the faculty in a department, meet together and deliberate about new hires, and that it's done through some kind of consensus formation process, which may be, in the end, a vote, but that the process is to try to build a consensus around. And that's the standard procedure. So that's what you expect. It's just taken for granted. You expect there to be to a greater or lesser extent, a democratic procedure by which new faculty get added. Now, what the boundary of that decision-making process is contested. It varies from university to university. Sometimes it's just the tenured people. Sometimes it's all faculty. Some places students are part of the same process. You know, that varies. But that it not be a unilateral decision by some higher up, that's just taken for granted. And that occurred through a process of contestation and change, you know, largely in the some of it in the 60s, some of it before. So one can imagine the same thing could occur. Exactly what the process by which you could get there is not so clear, but could occur with respect to the general question about employment. People just take it for granted that when you get hired for a job, the person who hires you has the right to tell you what to do on the job. Right? That if you own the means of production, you can delegate to others, that is your managers, authority to tell the employees what to do. As opposed to the taken for granted assumption being that when you're hired into a social organization that we call an enterprise, all members of that enterprise should be empowered to participate equally in the collective decision making whenever there's important decisions to be made. You know, could just take that for granted. You could still have private property. I mean, it's not an unthinkable form of economy to have private investors who get a return on their investment, but no authority rights come from that. You know, so that investing is like putting your money in a bank. I mean, you put your money in a savings account, you get a return on your investment, but you have no right to tell the bank what to do. It doesn't give you any voting rights. So you could have a still private property, but with no authority rights coming with it. The fact that we associate authority rights with ownership is just because of the way the power relations have generated the laws and the rules of the game around the use of property. We've blocked authority rights completely with respect to private property in certain respects. The fact that you own something doesn't give you the right to expose your workers to toxic fumes. You might do it anyway, but you don't have the legal right to do it, or to dangerous equipment. So we've blocked some of the aspects of the property rights. And one can imagine, I mean, this would be the kind of symbiotic metamorphosis transformation. You can imagine other property rights gradually being eroded without completely eliminating private ownership. And I would describe those as hybrid systems. That is, you know, a capitalism in which you lose the rights of authority with private ownership still has some capitalist features. You're the residual claimant on the surplus, but you've socialized some crucial aspects of property rights. Yeah.
So it seems to me that in order to reach such a state, you need to kind of expand the social, in order to reach that sort of cultural change, or like a change in expectations, please, authority rights, you need to kind of reach a point of expansion of the social economy, if we assume that this the pathway transformation is going to happen, that inevitably we'll have to reach a tipping point the tipping point at which the change of attitudes takes place. And I'm just skeptical that this tipping point will be breached, uncontested, and there won't be a massive backlash from the existing power structure. And that you then can expand in a kind of evolutionary and interstitial way, right, in a way that, you know, that you can transcend this kind of backlash, basically.
Steve? Well, I'm wondering whether the capitalists have already prevented that sort of, are preventing that sort of movement where we distance authority from the ability to gain profit with the stock market. I mean, most investors, they're not the big powerful investors. Those people retain control and they can mobilize votes and stuff. But most people and the majority of them invest through various mechanisms which give them no real say. Now, your pension fund might complain about something, but for the average person, they're having no role at all in the control of that company. It's already there, isn't it?
Yeah. So this was Marx made the argument that you
when you get the joint stock company, you've partially socialized the means of production because you've given the actual control to the direction of the company to employees. It's just that they're still organized in an authoritarian hierarchical way, but it's not to the owners actually aren't having much to say about what goes on. So that's, you know, that's one account of it. Of course, the unconstrained ability to invest and disinvest imposes huge constraints on firms, and particularly the decisions to close down firms and move them abroad, things like that. Those are still being made by direct delegates of the ownership interests. They're not being made by the ordinary employees.
Based on profitability.
And based on profitability as the criterion.
But has it created a contradictory classification, if you will, between capitalists? I mean, the ownership society that's being promoted, where we're going to have broad participation in the stock market. You know, is that effectively what it is? Is capitalist hegemony to create a contradictory classification, which will dampen anger against
absolutely
the big capitalists?
Yeah, I mean,
it's the bailouts.
I'd say the same about like American democracy. The vote is so hijacked by that.
But it's the bailout story.
The fact that on at football games, one of the most common ads is for stockbrokers and e-trading.
Yeah.
So that we have the following peculiar feature. At least this was the data as of 2008. It may have changed because of the stock market crash, but that we had both increasing concentration of ownership and increasing diffusion of ownership. Both were occurring. You know, it's this peculiar feature that more and more people own at least some stock.
Mm-hmm.
But the percentage of stock owned by the top 1% keeps going up. So, you get more inequality and more diffusion going on. That's a really magical distributional property to get the tail as deep into the population as possible, the distribution, and concentrate it at the other. We're over our time. I hope it's okay. We're not getting through these all of our agenda items, obviously, but I hope. if anybody is feeling that things that they really care about are getting sidestepped because of the arbitrariness with which I organize the list, this requires initiative on your part. You have to just say, I really want my theme discussed, and then
I'll just keep asking until